SiriusXM's E Street Radio's Springsteen Community Conference. This month, Ben Lazar, John Frank, Flynn McClain, and John Pont focus on Bruce's exploration of different musical paths in the 1990s.
This is the Springsteen Community Conference on E Street Radio. I am Flynn McClain, and today we're talking about Bruce in the 90s. Well, Bruce wrapped up the 92-93 World Tour in June with two benefits in the New York area. And then it was back underground for a little bit. But this time, he wasn't playing the groundhog too much, as I believe it was in November or December of 93.
Yeah.
Word got out that Bruce had recorded a song for an upcoming Jonathan Demme film called Philadelphia. Bruce was doing the title track called Streets of Philadelphia, and it was quite a departure from what we had normally heard. Ben, what was your reaction to the song?
I got an advance cassette from a friend of mine who worked at Springsteen's publicity company. And I just thought the song was amazing right from the beginning. To me, it was like, it wasn't so much a return to form, but it was just a brilliant Springsteen song that really put you in, it reminded me of Nebraska in a certain sense, where it was putting you inside someone's experience, you know, really you stepping inside someone's shoes. I just thought it was amazing. And also, I loved the beat of it. It was modern. It was obviously, there was some hip hop influence to it. And so it just felt immediately relevant, and it kind of, whatever negative taste, I'm not saying there was particularly negative taste post Human Touch Lucky Town, for me, it just wiped the slate clean, and it was clear, like, okay, he's back.
I felt like a new beginning.
Yeah, completely. And, you know, I was working in the record industry then, and you could see the reaction immediately. People loved the song immediately. I think it was Bruce's last top 10 hit. People connected to that song in a way that they hadn't connected to the two albums beforehand.
Well, do you think it had something to do with the wonderful movie it was released with?
Certainly, I think it helped. But, you know, really, the song isn't that crucial in the movie. It's just in the opening credits. It's not really part of the movie itself. So I can't say that the movie is what made the song happen. I think the song happened because the song happened. I mean, Jonathan, I know you're a big fan of the song. You want to?
I love the song, but I think that song succeeds because Bruce Springsteen got back into context. He had something big to hang a new song on. He had a really good idea. He had a really beautiful melody. He had a great beat. But more importantly, he had something to do with it. He had an idea he was able to flesh out. And he had a good picture to put it in. And the one thing that's kind of curious is that he was backed up by Neil Young, who also had an equally great song in Philadelphia.
When you say backed up, I mean, Neil Young was not on the album. I mean, on that
song. But he was in the film. They used Neil Young's song at the very end of the film, just as they used Bruce's to open.
And right. I've always thought it was interesting that Jonathan Demme asked Bruce for like a real up-tempo rocker that he could play in the malls, and look what he got. And it's also important to mention that, you know, Bruce took the experience of someone very close to him, Christine Ann Carr, who Dave Marsh, Barbara Carr, his co-manager with John Landau, and Dave Marsh's daughter, who died of cancer in, I believe, early 1993, and really took part of her experience and put it in the song. And so it was something where Bruce made it both incredibly personal and incredibly universal, which is really, I think, when he's at his best, he's managed to pull those off simultaneously. And with Streets of Philadelphia, I think he did that spectacularly.
Totally agree. You can look at that song and say, well, it's about this character who's dying of AIDS in this movie. But at the same time, you know, he never mentions AIDS or HIV. And it's just, it can be applied. You can feel that way without being someone with AIDS.
Yeah, I mean,
the song is definitely not literal, but it's perfect. It fits perfectly within the context of the movie and perfectly within the context of the story he's trying to tell.
You know, 2 years after, you know, having quote unquote two failures, relative failures, all of a sudden, he's won an Oscar, and he's won 4 Grammys, and for Song of the Year, and all of a sudden, Bruce Springsteen is back.
He was back.
He was back.
Reflection in the window, no my own face, brother. Gonna leave me wasting away on the streets of Philadelphia. Vanished and gone. Tonight I hear the blood in my veins, just as black and whispering as the rain. The streets of Philadelphia.
XM's E Street Radio's Springsteen Community Conference, focusing on Bruce's exploration of different musical paths in the 1990s.
What happened next?
Well,
he apparently did spend a good chunk of 1994 working on a new album.
Well, he'd been doing that since 1993, working with
Tommy Sims,
Zach Alford, Shane Fontaine, the core of the touring band. Yeah.
So the point was, I believe, once they had this great song, Streets of Philly, that was going to win all these awards, all these Grammys, they needed to release it on an actual Bruce Springsteen album. Previously, it had only been released on the soundtrack, and you're right, and the single. So now they had to have something
to hang their hat on.
Exactly. It's a Bruce Springsteen album. And so I guess they spent a good chunk of 94 trying to get, I guess, 9 to 11 more songs to put on there. It never happened,
and Bruce called the band back together for some recording in January of 95. And you know, that was for the Greatest Hit Sessions, out of that came Murder Incorporated, which was still the 1982 version, and a re-record of This Hard Land and Blood Brothers and
Secret Garden.
Exactly. Right.
Frankie was not re-recorded, I believe. Yes. Frankie was just
on there.
They seriously considered it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they really did. But,
so, you know, what do we think of the E Street Band songs from 1995?
Well, as the usual, Mikey.
You loved him.
I did, except, you know what? If I never heard Secret Garden again,
it'd be fine.
It would be fine with me.
Yeah, it'd be fine with me too.
You know,
yeah.
And it's interesting to note the ambivalence, for lack of a better word, for that last verse of Blood Brothers. You could tell, I mean, even then you could tell he really wasn't into playing with the band at that point.
There's actually alternate outtakes of Blood Brothers that I really love.
Yeah,
I think the version
they put out isn't that great. I think that there are other versions that really
well. There's
kick
the rock
its butt.
Version. Are you talking about another one?
There are two rock versions. There's the one that they put on the Blood Brothers EP, and then there's the one on Deep Down in the Vaults. The one on Deep Down in the Vaults is close to being one of the earliest versions that they recorded. I mean, when they did the movie, the Ernie Fritz movie in '96, you know, there's the arrangement that Bruce just opens the movie with him on acoustic, and to me that was the best version of the song.
Yeah,
they had
that.
I mean,
was pretty sweet.
I think it was amazing.
And they beat it into the ground.
Well,
they really did work hard on getting the arrangement to that one. I mean, as you saw in the film, you know, Bruce, you know what, stayed up all night.
Yeah,
you know, getting, and he looked it too, trying to find the right lyrics, the right feel, the right music, everything.
But they also recorded, you know, to me, one of great Bruce's great 90s songs in those sessions, Back in Your Arms, mm-hmm. which, you know, a colossal song.
Yep.
You know, when I first saw it in Blood Brothers, I couldn't believe they didn't put it out. I thought it blew away pretty much anything they recorded in 95. So
that's true.
And
that was a very odd decision.
Yeah, that was, to me, that was a pretty odd decision.
So what was your reaction when you heard that the outtake, Waiting on the End of the World?
It was a nothing song.
So I don't think there was enough material from that, from those sessions, to extrapolate into a full album.
Yeah.
I mean, people like to fantasize that, oh, he was going to go in there for 4 days of greatest hits recording and come out and say, you know what, I'm going to release this new album with the E Street Band. It was never going to happen.
That would have been a big mistake, I think. Those two songs were good placeholders. They sort of said, yeah, we're here, we're all kicking, and we're making music together. And
we're a good adult contemporary band at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're all still friends.
That's what they sounded like, doesn't it?
They were really adult contemporary songs. They were not,
they weren't E Street Band songs.
Nope.
They were not E Street Band songs at all. I mean, Back in Your Arms, I think, works as an E Street Band song just because it's a soul ballad. But the rest, I don't think, really worked all that great.
I wonder.
Which goes back to the ambivalence thing. It's sort of like, well, if these are the songs I have, why do I want to put the E Street Band back together at this point?
Did anybody see the Tramp show they did when they shot the video?
I went to the Sony Studios show.
Which apparently was nothing like Tramp.
I think, Bruce, it was an industry crowd at the Sony Studios shows. And it was not much of a vibe. Bruce was, recording it for European television. You know, the magic was, I was right up front. It was a thrill. I mean, when Bruce did the solo and Prove It All Night, he was literally 2 inches from my face. I mean, I was ecstatic. And in retrospect, not that great a show.
One, two, three, four. Well, hey there, mister. Tell me what happened to the seaside song. Can you give me a reason, sir? As to why they never grown. They just blown around from town to town till they're back out on these fields where they fall for my hand back into the dirt of this hard land. Me and my sister from Durban town, we did ride. We made our beds from the rock on the mountainside. We've been blown around from town to town, looking for a place to stand with a sunburst. Like a circle of fire down on this island.
Street Radio's Springsteen Community Conference, focusing on Bruce's exploration of different musical paths in the 1990s, exclusively on Sirius XM.
Max Weimer could improve tremendously from playing swing songs five nights a week on the Conan O'Brien show, where he was the music director from 1993 on. So, you know, to me, that was really seeing him improve was one of the best parts of seeing the band back together. But it was just clear whether it was explicitly understood or not that the band wasn't really back together. And this was kind of a placeholder as Bruce was trying to figure out what he was going to do next. And I remember they did that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame show in September, and that was...
There was no spark at that show.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, I drove like 8 hours from D.C. to get there, and it's almost like I drove 8 hours to see She's the One in Darkness.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not even Born to Run, which had just been voted like the best rock song of all time by one of the British magazines. And I don't think we missed much by the E Street Band not reuniting at that point.
Yeah, I just don't think Bruce was ready for it.
It wasn't time.
Yeah.
I don't think he was writing songs in that vein. I think it would have been a sort of a mistake to say, well, look, everyone's here. Obviously, the public's kind of ready for it. Maybe it's been long enough. But clearly, Bruce had other ideas, other avenues to explore. I mean, if the 1990s, they were only halfway through, he had other things he wanted to do.
That's right.
It wasn't time.
And I think he was trying to, you know, have songs for the band. I mean, as we're going to get to talk about The Ghost of Tom Jones in a minute, you know, he said he wrote those songs initially as something to write for the band, but he quickly realized that they were going to work much better in a solo acoustic format.
Where have we heard that before?
Yes, where have we heard that before?
Yep.
However, you know, I wouldn't say that The Ghost of Tom Jones is Nebraska, but that's a whole
nothing
other...
Nothing is.
So in November of 1995, Bruce released The Ghost of Tom Jones. Very intense, dark collection, brooding collection of acoustic songs. When you first heard The Ghost of Tom Joad, what did you think, John?
Well, when I first got the album, you know, I expected one thing, which was Nebraska Part 2. Then I got into the album, and it clearly was not Nebraska Part 2 at all. And I remember being immediately struck by the title track, which I immediately loved and played on repeat many, many, many times. The rest of the album took a while for me to get into and had a lot of interesting minimalist arrangements and, you know, minimalist playing on it. I didn't love it right away, but it took me a while to really warm up to it. Then Ben and I, you and I saw a show together in
Asbury in 96.
In Asbury of 96. And that made me want to go back and re-listen to it again. And some of those live versions, you know, we'll talk about the tour in a minute, but, you know, some of the versions of the songs live made me go back instantly and revisit the album. And, you know, looking back at it now, I still really, really like the record. You know, clearly, again, it's not Nebraska, nor is it Devils in Dust, but a really, really good record overall.
Flynn, what'd you think?
This is one situation where songs that had more instrumentation on them that really grabbed me. Like that was Youngstown, The Ghost of Tom Jode, even Across the Border. Those are my favorite songs right off from the get-go.
Across the Border is pretty great.
Yes, yes it is. You know, and so not often you hear a pop song talking about methamphetamines or a shoe salesman, as Bruce once talked about.
With Highway 29, yeah.
Exactly. And some of that stuff I kind of got a little bit lost on. But when he took it on the road and he was telling those wonderful stories, but to set up the songs, they took on a whole new meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan, what'd you think of the album?
I think Flynn's right. It took hearing those songs in the live setting for me to appreciate what I was hearing on the record. The production wasn't quite right for an acoustic record. It was sort of trying to sound a little bit fleshed out, but when it did, the songs, they ultimately sort of laid flat on the record. But when you went to hear them at the shows, they really stood up. But what I really liked was the lyrical content.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that Bruce was writing sort of, again, sort of where he'd left off with Streets of Philadelphia, with a broader
social storytelling,
narrative, social context. All those things had sort of returned again.
And you got to say, completely different characters. I mean, he was writing in a setting, the American Southwest and the Mexican border, which he had never addressed before. These were not the characters that we had followed along from
readings. It wasn't Crazy Janie or Mission Man.
No, that there was a break.
Complete Western imagery. All those characters that we'd followed for so long had been shelved for the time being. And I think Bruce was still living in Los Angeles at that point. Yeah. And I think he commented, in fact, that he'd been reading a lot in the Los Angeles Times about border issues. And that's,
clearly that had a huge impact on, you know,
shaping that record.
Storytelling of the record.
Yeah, it's very much, you know, Governor Pete Wilson's California in the mid-1990s. Right. That record absolutely reflects that. I mean, I got to say, I liked the album, and I still like the album, but it never, the love, never, I never found the love for it.
Well, it's not something you're going to listen to repeatedly.
But then I'd ask the question, like, why do I listen to Nebraska repeatedly, and I don't listen to The Ghost of Tom Joad repeatedly?
Because Nebraska was sort of a mistake, and The Ghost of Tom Joad was something that was very consciously worked at.
I think that's perfect. I think Nebraska, you could feel coming from Bruce's heart, and there's a lot of Ghost of Tom Joad where you feel it coming from Bruce's head.
Yeah.
So I think
that that makes it at all wrong.
No, it doesn't make it wrong, but it's just
different.
It just makes it very, very different.
Yeah. It hits on a different level.
Well, you're talking about Shoots of Philadelphia being a very universal and specific song at the same time. That cannot be said of the Ghost of Tom Joad record. You can't really interpret certain songs like Sinaloa Cowboys in any other way than about two Mexican brothers.
No, I mean, the lyrical content
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to address that because I think you can. I don't agree with that, and I'll tell you why. I think you're talking about one family member losing another family member. That's also at the core of the song. Sure, like, I haven't been involved in the methamphetamine trade lately, but, but you know, I've lost a family member, and I remember hearing it even before I saw it live, and I got that. I think there are certain parts of the thing that were universal despite the very specific narrative details of the song. But production, I think where Nebraska just felt completely authentic
and natural
and unforced, it was Bruce. You could almost feel Bruce trying to figure out what works and never quite getting it right in a production context in terms of whether to flesh it out more or to make it even more minimalistic. I think the songs were melodically somewhat underbaked. I think, you know, those songs sometimes would call for maybe a nice riff or a melody here and there, and they just weren't there. These were really bare bones songs in settings where they could have used a little bit more fleshing out, I thought.
You sort of wonder why he didn't take those out on the road and do 10 or 12 dates just to see how they sounded live, because I think they would have sounded different on the record had they done some live work and had he come back and said, okay, you know what, this is how this song, by dint of having played it, this is how it should sound when I record it.
Patrick Humphreys, who wrote book on Born in the USA, said the test of how well the production on a Bruce Springsteen record is by seeing how much did they improve the song live. And I think in the context of The Ghost of Tom Joad, all those songs were improved live. I don't think there's one where the studio version's the definitive version. You know, we'll be talking about the tour in a second, but I think, you know, the album, I personally never really go back to it. I know some people really love it. There's some people who really, really love that album. For me, I like it. I respect it. I think there's some Across the Board is a great song. I think Dry Lightning, Highway 29, I think those are really colossal songs. I think The Line is a great song too. I remember when I was very happy when I heard it on the Devils and Dust tour. Really, really great song. Heartbreaking song. I just don't think he nailed it as a record. And I think if one theme for me in terms of the 90s with Bruce Springsteen, it's he lost his production mojo. I don't think he ever lost his songwriting mojo or his performance mojo or his commitment. But in terms of how to make records, I think he got a little off track in the 90s. It's just a perfect time for some music. From the fall of 1995, this is The Ghost of Tom Joad on E Street Radio's Springsteen Community Conference.
Walking along the railroad tracks, going someplace and there's no going back. Highway patrol choppers coming up over the ridge, hot soup on a campfire in the bridge, shelter line stretching around the corner. Welcome to the new world order. Sleeping in the car in the southwest. No
home, no job, no peace, no rest. Well, the highway is alive tonight, but nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes. I'm sitting down here in the campfire line, searching for the ghost of Tom Joe. He pulls a prayer book out of his sleeping bag. Preacher lights up a butt and takes a drag, waiting for when the last shall be first and the first shall be last. In a cardboard box near the underpass, got a one-way ticket to the promised land. You got a hole in your belly and a gun in your hand, sleeping on a pillow of solid rock, breathing in the city aqueduct. The highway is alive tonight. Where it's headed, everybody knows. I'm sitting down here in the campfire line, waiting on the ghost.
SiriusXM's E Street Radio's Springsteen Community Conference. This month, Ben Lazar, John Frank, Flynn McLean, and John Pont focus on Bruce's exploration of different musical paths in the 1990s.
Hi, welcome back to the Springsteen Community Conference on E Street Radio. I'm Ben Lazar, and we're talking today about Bruce Springsteen in the 1990s. So, Bruce Springsteen in November of 1995 released The Ghost of Tom Joad. And then on November 21st, 1995, at the State Theater in New Brunswick, New Jersey, as a rehearsal show, he went out and started the tour. I was there that night. Jonathan, were you there that night?
I was.
What'd you think about the show?
It was a real contrast to what we saw in 1990, where there was sort of this tentativeness, this nervousness. In 1995, Bruce Springsteen came out on that stage and knew exactly what he was going to do. He knew all the material that he wanted to choose from. And it set the direction for the rest of the tour, for his first solo tour.
Did you think it was effective? I mean, did you think the show worked? Did you love the show when you first saw
it? Yeah, because it was conceptually complete on the first night. He could have done that same exact set from start to finish, and it would have been a thematic show in and of itself that worked from start to finish.
I remember being a little confounded by it.
How so?
Well, it was just so relentless. Like, there was such little light in it. It was before Bruce really, you know, later on the tour, Bruce
opened it up.
opened it up.
That's some fun.
And I remember, you know, the first encore was "Does This Bus Stop at 82nd Street?" I was like, okay, he's going to play some fun songs. And then it was like, bang, right? It was Galveston Bay. And, you know, he closed with "My Best Is Never Good Enough." And it was just relentless. So that show, which I liked very much, but even when I saw him in Philly, I guess 2 weeks later, and then I saw him at the Beacon Theater on December 17th, and you could just see the show evolving and seeing him getting his footing as he does, you know, on every tour, but you could see something special was really happening. And then I think by the spring and summer, it was just a completely different beast altogether.
One question I've been really aching to ask here, what was the crowd's reaction at that show at the State Theater or at the Basie?
Well, I think he sort of set the tone. He's like, we're here. Hello, how are you? Now,
shut the fuck
everyone, up. Everyone, shut the fuck up. And from the first night on, that was...
Well, how did the crowd shut the fuck up?
Pretty much.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. I remember there were a couple of people who were yelling, but, you know...
He had some problems at the Beacon, I remember.
Yeah.
And there were people who didn't quite get it at first, but he was explicit. He said, listen, your money's at the box office if you want it, but leave. And he didn't have to do that very often, but...
The one complaint I got from some fans who weren't particularly hardcore fans was that the show was boring. And if you weren't a hardcore Bruce Springsteen fan, I could understand that. I mean, that what became called the Border Suite, those group of four songs set in the Southwest, you know, those were very monochromatic songs. And it took something to really stay engaged with them. If you did, I think you were rewarded. I certainly felt very rewarded by them. I thought they were great.
I felt very tested.
Yeah, you felt very tested?
Yep. And I kind of felt like the show... You know, for lack of a better analogy, it kind of felt like Muhammad Ali in that Larry Holmes fight when he just kept getting hit and just taking the hit. And you're like, wow, does this ever end till the refs stop the fight? You know, and I kind of felt like that. And I only saw this tour, I think, 3 or 4 times. And for me, it was really heavy and really hard to get through. And when the show ended, I felt a sense of almost relief, like, okay, now it's over kind of thing, you know?
Well, the kind of... piggyback on that, there were times when I felt, especially during those last 4 songs, that he was lecturing.
And I felt no levity in the show. I just felt, like Ben said before, like, you know, it was very dark, very heavy, very somber, you know, and it tested even the most faithful Springsteen fan, I think, you know, in a lot of ways.
And I have to say that when he took that tour into theaters, into like small, like 2,000, 2,500 seat theater. I mean,
where it
like,
belonged.
Right. In the Fox Theater in Atlanta. I saw him down there. Kind of like Constitution Hall in D.C. was probably one of the bigger venues, at least, of that first leg.
And he definitely picked the right type of venues when he went into the theater.
So he was making, just through Darwinism, he was saying, these shows are for my hardcore fan.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to get back to what Ben had to say, because I think that Bruce challenged people with the way he looked, the way he played, the material he chose to play, how he chose to play it. It wasn't the hits at all. But listen what he did with Born in the USA. He made it unmistakable on that tour. And he said, listen, I want you to listen to this and I want to make it as clear as I can. And I thought he did that with the rest of the material as well. It was a very clear indication. Don't you think so?
I mean, the one thing I'll say is, you know, the version of Promised Land that he did.
Sure.
I remember the first time I heard it, it was almost out of body.
For people who may not have heard that, why don't you describe that? Maybe then we'll play it.
You know, he completely deconstructed the song, as he sometimes does, and made it almost unrecognizable. You know, it had a very odd rhythmic...
syncopated...
Yeah.
I mean, he's using the guitar as a drum.
Right.
Right.
And he changed the key and changed the arrangement and...
There was no melody.
And
the
instead
original, anyway.
He took, you know, one of his most classic stadium type rockers and deconstructed it into almost like a death march, you know, and that completely blew me away. And the first few times I really had no idea what to make of it. I found it really puzzling, you know, and then I came around to going, it's pretty amazing, but it took me a while to figure that out again, as a diehard fan.
And I think, you know, we haven't really talked about this much, but that version of that song started in Europe in the spring of 96 when he went over there. And I think Bruce feels a freedom in Europe that he does not often feel in the United States to really experiment and try things out. The tour took on a character when he hit Europe that I think the tour really opened up and really started to blossom. And, you know, speaking to you know, Born in the USA. I think one of the things that Bruce did was he provided so much context. He spoke more than he had in any tour since the Born in the USA tour, and certainly more than he's spoken at any tour since, well, maybe Devils in Dust, but certainly he spoke voluminously about a lot of things and, you know, explained really, you know, Born in the USA, there's a lot of money being misunderstood, you know, really addressed that from the stage. Talked about, you know, the rap before Dry Lightning, about how he had been in the same, you know, been in many relationships over the past 30 years, but they'd all been the same relationship with different people.
It's also the same relationship for 30 years,
you know, just with different people.
If there's this dichotomy with Bruce Springsteen, you can almost trace it to his parents. There's his mom, which is the sunny, you know, the exuberance, and then there's his father, which is the darkness. And that tour was Douglas Springsteen in action. Like, that part of Bruce, like, was really happening. And I thought when it succeeded incredibly well. I think Across the Border and Nightly, when Bruce, you know, Bruce invented a new voice for that tour.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the twang, which a lot of people feel ambivalently about, but the falsetto voice that he's employed on other songs and other tours since, that started on that tour. And I think when he would do these ethereal falsetto sounds at the end of Across the Border, it blew my mind. I mean, it had me in tears pretty much every time. And I think, you know, the last community conference we did, we were talking about Born in the USA. I think The Ghost of Tom Joad and the tour was the completion of the ratcheting down of the Born in the USA process, taking the tour into 2,000 seaters. And also, it was almost like a community tour. He was playing in super small towns. Mm-hmm. Some that he had never toured in before.
Fresno, California,
like really getting into the fabric of communities in a way that he hadn't done since
very early tours.
And he was not conscious of it then, the way he was obviously conscious of it.
Because that's where those theaters are. All these theaters in the great cities in Portland, Oregon, you know, is on Broadway. But if you want to play at the Rose Garden Arena, where he's played several times, you know, that's across the bridge. It's a little bit out of the main square.
Yeah, and he was addressing stuff that no one was really talking about. Yeah. I mean, if you think about the lyrical content of Youngstown, you know, I've heard accounts, I wasn't at the show, but playing Youngstown in Youngstown, Ohio, for those people was just an incredible experience for everybody. For him, it was seeing his songs come to life and touching those people who had lived it. It was no longer a conceptual experience. It was experiential. I think that was a huge experience for Bruce and his music. And I think it really was reflected on some really great performances on that tour.
I think that's why he also played a lot of those small towns in California. Mm-hmm. Was it Fresno? And where was the benefit show for John Steinbeck?
San Jose, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was an amazing show.
I mean, and then playing his high school his Catholic school gymnasium, yeah, right? In Freehold. And then, you know, if you had said even in 1992, oh, Bruce is going to do three nights at the Paramount Theater in Asbury, you'd have been like,
no way.
And he did them. And I think it was a tour that brought a lot full circle for Bruce.
I think it also certainly brought back, again, for the hardcores. You know, I mean, after Bruce went for the brass ring in 92 with the two new rock albums and the big international arena tour, and you know, some of the old fans kind of got a little bit, you know, disillusioned or whatever, but then when he came back to Joad and it was just Bruce.
Do you think the hardcore was unambivalently behind that tour or
behind Joad?
Yeah,
I do.
Okay.
I do.
Absolutely.
We were there. I saw the last four shows on that American leg in December, going from Cincinnati to Columbus to Nashville to Charlotte. And it was like, I saw the same people at every show.
Right.
I have a quick question for Jonathan, actually, who mentioned seeing the last two shows in Paris, right?
No, I've heard them. Oh. I was not there.
Well, let's talk about those shows for just a quick second, because a big part of these shows was the talking bits and him talking about the context of the songs. And again, there's a language barrier in Europe, and it's interesting to see how these songs are very specifically tied to, you know, one part of the country. And I was wondering how the reaction to that was in Europe and those tapes that you guys heard.
Well, apparently, I know at least in Spain, they were still very feverish about it.
Spain doesn't count, Flynn.
I think it goes beyond just regional reaction. I think for a lot of people who are not in the U.S., that they listen to Bruce Springsteen's music because he represents something that is uniquely American or that has a lot to do with the American dream or the loss of the American dream.
Mm-hmm. Or the America they love.
Or the America they love. Or the America they imagine.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is. And I think going back to what you said, Ben, that the reason Bruce has a lot more freedom to do what he does when he gets to Europe is because these people they treat him a little bit differently than we do.
Well, I think they treat the art more respectfully there than they do here.
Well, right.
If we go back about a half an hour in our conversation, the 92 tour started with, 3 weeks in Europe?
Yeah.
And I think that, and actually the 99 tour started with several months in Europe, and I don't think that's a coincidence.
Not at all.
No.
I think it builds his confidence and makes him feel, you know.
Well, he can try things and not feel
constrained.
Yeah. Right. There's an elasticity to that audience that they're...
Not here. Just,
it doesn't exist
here. Yeah, there's a fickleness to the American audience. And, you know, I remember reading an interview with Melissa Etheridge where she was talking about how Bruce counseled her, make sure you build an audience in Europe because they will stick around.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
They're loyal.
Well, talking about the Joe tour, we've all talked about the seriousness of it. But I think tour was the first time Bruce really had some fun on that stage. It wasn't for the full 2.5 hours, but he cracked some jokes. I mean, you had Sell It and They Will Come, which was Bruce's riff on infomercials on Late at Night. You know, Tony Little, go kill yourself. You know, cutting your hair with a bowl or a vacuum cleaner. And then that moved on to Pilgrim and the Temple of Love, which was about a parking lot encounter between Santa Claus and a stripper, and then being in the strip joint on Christmas Eve. But it was the fact that in the middle of this incredibly serious show, he wanted to bring some levity to it.
But it was a different kind of levity, because Bruce had brought levity to his shows before. I mean, Bruce is pretty funny. This was a kind of levity meets vulgarity. I think it was the first time that Bruce had ever really been vulgar on stage. And I'm not saying that as a diss to Bruce, but
I think I think
it was deliberate. I think it was absolutely deliberate that he was.
I think, again, it was a testing ground for that audience.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it was, again, like, this is who I am.
It was not accidental by any stretch of the
like it or not. You know.
I think that's how he is.
Yeah.
There was one interview, and I forget which publication it was with, where he said, that was a tour when I didn't have to play Bruce Springsteen. I could just be Bruce Springsteen.
Right.
And I think when he did Sell It and They Will Come, and he did Pilgrim to the Temple of Love, and he did the Redheaded Woman intro talking about cunnilingus and the Bill Clinton doing cunnilingus, you know, that's Bruce. And right. I thought that was hilarious, and I think a lot of other people did too.
So I think it'd be a really good time to get into some music. We're going to be playing a couple songs from the Ghost of Tom Joad tour. First up is the version of Promised Land from April 24th, 1996 at the Brixton Academy in London, England.
Great one.
And then we're going to play Across the Border from Paris, May of 1997, the final night of the Ghost of Tom Joad tour.
Now to live the right way. I get up every morning and go to work each day. But your eyes go blind and your blood runs down.
Sometimes I feel so weak, I just want to explode. Explode and tear this whole town apart. Take a knife and cut this pain from my heart. Try to find somebody to the sun in the sky. Well, adults on Main Street, how does they understand? I could take this moment into my hands, Mr. Hyena Barnum. I believe I'm a slave.
Thank you, Brixton.